accession number 18493, wheel 21.
Mr. Lupton, reel 21. Just to clarify that about getting to the engine in a grant, are you saying you could get at it from the top of the engine deck as well as from sort of ground level, as a sort of back door to the tank as well?
You could do, yes. Well, you had to be able to, really, because there wasn't enough room when you'd opened the back panels to get all the way around it as you would need to for, well, certain parts of maintenance anyway. And so there was also a deck that could be opened underneath the back of the turret, you know, on the engine cover, top cover sort of. But that wasn't readily available. You had to, you know, undo a lot of bolts and all that kind of thing. But it was there, you could get at it. And you could also get down the back part of the engine then too, or the fitters could.
Was it a difficult tank to maintain?
No, we always found it quite easy. There was a limit to what we could do, the crew of the tank, the driver, or anybody else who was engine inclined, what we could do, because with these being aero, designed for aero use, aeroplane use, they weren't everybody's. Not everybody could play with them. So we had to call the fitters in, perhaps more than we used to do with the Crusaders and things like that. But as far as we were concerned, as far as we could go, they were easy to maintain. And the tanks, generally, too. Tracks and drives and clutches and all this kind of thing.
What was it like to drive?
Cumbersome, but no more difficult really than our previous Crusaders and the Stuarts, which were quite easy to control and drive. And although you had to watch out a bit more around, you know, for measurements of heights and widths and so on, once you got used to that, there wasn't any difficulty in driving them.
What sort of steering did you have?
Again, it was sticks, left and right sticks, driving through clutches to the track. Track drives, and there wasn't any great strain on it. It was still as easy to control as the lighter tanks we'd had before.
Yeah, you would expect it. I mean, it looks as if it weighed, well, I think it does weigh very significantly more than your Stuart. One
yes.
would expect it to be a more difficult drive, but.
But it's no, it was quite a nice, easy drive.
So, this was when you were at Baghdad, is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Now, what was your next move, or what was the next significant thing that happened with the regiment?
Well, we had, first of all, whilst we were still in Baghdad, around late November, early December.
This is, sorry,
43,
that's right.
Yes. We had some people who were sent, they were sent a long way to Cairo, in fact, to learn something about the next tanks we were eventually going to get supplied to us to replace the Grants. And I was fortunate in being one of them who went on what was called Nairn's bus service. They were two brothers, New Zealanders, who'd started, called Nairn, who started this up after the First World War. And you drove on a bus, proper coach, from Baghdad right over to Damascus, across plain desert after a while, but the drivers knew the way, and they also got flat tires too, as we found on the way, which made it a little awkward in soft sand, but still they got us to Damascus all right. And then we had to get a train from Damascus down to Cairo. We had been supplied with usual army rations to take with us on this trip. As a matter of fact, I suppose there were about half a dozen altogether from our unit who went down. And we got as far as, I forget where it was, somewhere in Palestine, as it was then, stopped to take on some Americans on this train who loaded up with their own rations. And so we joined in the back of their queue and got some of their rations too to eat on the journey, which were extremely good rations, far different from our bouillon biscuits or whatever we had. And nobody ever bothered about that anyway. We just put our heads down and joined in. It was night time, so nobody bothered to notice us. And we got down to Cairo and sent to Abbasiyah Barracks. And the course was being conducted there on Sherman tanks, and there were three different models of Sherman tanks. One model was powered by the 9-cylinder radial engines. One model was powered by motor torpedo boat diesel engines, which were great powerful things. And the third model was powered, we got these, I'll tell you. The third model was powered with Chevrolet engines, in which they had taken 5 6-cylinder Chevrolet truck engines and put them around one shaft. So you had 30 cylinders driving one shaft, and you had to keep that tuned up perfectly too. And they still used 3 gallons to the mile petrol. So you didn't get a very long run in them. But all the bodies were the same. They had these different engines, and we had instruction on each of them. And we had about a month in Cairo. Plenty of good rugby and things like that. Then we drove back. Well, we went back on the train up to Damascus, took the Nairn's bus back on New Year's Eve, and landed back on New Year's Day at Baghdad. And we then knew all that we were expected to know about Sherman tanks. But the unit itself, for that month or however long we, as about a month we were away, were still carrying on with the same duties they had had when we left. And it was only shortly after we arrived back in the new year that we moved on then to Syria. and mostly we drove, but the tanks were taken on transporters, and we arrived first of all at Homs, only for a couple of days, a very primitive camp like the one which we had first got in near Basra, and then we moved on to outside Aleppo, where we stayed for a short while before they decided where to move us again. And we didn't have a great deal of movement around when we were in Syria, but we were there in case the Germans still decided to come down to the Iraq oil fields. And then they moved us on from Aleppo to near, well, Beirut. It was Baalbek, where we finished up around there. We had been nearer Beirut for a short while, down near the coast road, and then they moved us to Baalbek, which is over the mountains between the sea and Syria, which was the other side of us. Baalbek is quite an interesting, beautiful place with old Roman ruins standing around, and a beautiful mountain which had snow on it even later in the year. And in fact, they used to say that when the snow melted from there, the war would end. I don't know whether it was because we weren't near it when the war ended, but I don't know whether the snow had melted by then. But it was about 10,000 feet up anyway, where the snow was. And the river that came through Baalbek came from that snowfield, and it had lovely cold water where we could cool our beer and tie it on a string and dunk it in the river for an hour or so. Anyway, we stayed there for quite a while at Baalbek, and eventually, whilst we were there, we got re-equipped with Shermans, and they were the petrol-driven G General Motor thing, 30-cylinder jobs. So everybody else had to start learning how to maintain those things and generally run them about, and we did plenty of firing up in the mountains and so on for practice. Funny thing, mainly we seemed to fire over into Syria. I don't know why, but it must have been a good place to get rid of shot, because there was nothing there where we were firing at anyway. But we got well trained on using, maintaining, and generally looking after these Sherman tanks.
Were you being used as to help train the rest of the unit because of your course?
Yes, we were. And I had then been made up also to sergeant, and I was transferred from C Squadron to HQ Squadron then, and we used to, several of us, go around and teach people about these tanks. The other people in the unit who hadn't been lucky enough to go to Cairo, if you could say that. But everybody, by the time we were ready to move off from there, was fully acquainted with Shermans and what they could do and how to look after them properly.
Are there any peculiarities that you know, I mean, it sounds like an incredibly complicated arrangement.
Well,
30 cylinders, I mean, it just...
Well, you didn't have just one carburetor, you had five carburetors in there. And you had to keep these things tuned so that all 30 cylinders were chugging around nice and smoothly and so on. It was quite a job to look after them. Plus, I forget what the size of the fuel capacity was, but it certainly wasn't more than 200 gallons. It may have been 150, which meant that you could probably only drive 50 miles on a tank full. So wherever they were going to be used, they weren't going to be used in big mobile battles. They had to be in more established positions. But eventually, you know, people got used to these things. You could, there again, you could open up the top. Especially, you had to be able to open up the top there, really. Because if you open up the back, all you could see was the end of the engine. And you had six cylinders going away from you, so you had to be able to open up the top to be able to see everything that was there. And the fitters had, they didn't have too much of a problem. Most people seemed to be able to maintain them, especially as the engines were not special in that they were ordinary truck engines. Six cylinder, I forget how many horsepower, 40 horsepower, something like that, general motor engines. And each one, that is, so you had about 200 horsepower there behind you. And we found them a very good machine. Very good machine to manoeuvre, to generally deal with, drive, and so on. The tracks were good. They didn't get... they didn't break like ours had done on the Crusaders and so on. They could be broken by being hit by some shot, but it took a lot more to damage them. And the whole body of the tank, of course, was a much stronger thing. It was, well, all the front part and the cupola, the turret, were cast, and they were, I think, about 3 to 4 inches thick in cast metal, and the plates in the other parts where they needed plates around the engine and on top at the back, also down under the front, they were all good solid metal, maybe an inch thick in most cases, except around the engine, which was, or on top of the engine, which was a bit thinner, so as you could lift it up decently. The accommodation inside was quite comfortable and roomy. And the shot were around the turret, and what would it hold? I couldn't say how many shot it would hold. 40, perhaps 40. And they would be mixed shot. You could have solid shot, phosphorus, smoke shot, and high explosive. And the loader had good room to manoeuvre. The viewing the sighting for the gunner was again more or less the same as we'd had before. That was a telescope, but there was also a periscope where you could see the general view, and the telescope was one which was again with a cross in the center and marked with a certain range or range or ranges on it. With those you could of course fire quite a good distance, because you had a long, fairly long barrel, not long compared to the modern ones, but long for us, and you could shoot about 3,000 yards anyway with a fair degree of accuracy. And of course you had full traverse and full elevation and depression on the gun, on the main gun. There was also a coaxial machine gun alongside it. There was also, let me think, I can't be sure on this, but I think there was also another machine gun alongside the driver at the front. And there was another one mounted up by the commander's aperture out, so that any aircraft coming over could be shot at. And we thought they were a very good tank. Well, they were for us. Nothing like the Tigers or Panthers of the Germans, unfortunately, but good enough.
So it was welcomed after the grant, was it?
Yes, it was. And I think everybody was very happy with them.
Because the main gun was, I don't think you said, it was the same calibre, wasn't it? But just a longer...
Yes, it was a longer barrel, so you get a much better accuracy with it. Because it has a long spiral to go down, rifling, as compared with the fairly short one of the Grant. Yes, there was one thing when we were out on gunnery, the 75mm practice one day, firing from Lebanon into Syria. We had all the ammunition delivered and it was stacked outside the tanks, so that it was only loaded into the tanks when they went to do their firing practice. And I noticed a couple of hours smouldering outside the tank, and I thought, doesn't look very nice. It was stacked up with the solid shot at the bottom and then some smoke and high explosive on top, I think. And so these were the smoke ones, I think. And eventually there were about five shot. They were smoking at the tip of the shot itself. So I said, well, we're going to shift those because I don't want something to happen here and blow us and the tank up. And I certainly wasn't going to load them inside. So two of us carried these things till we got just beyond the reach of the nearest tanks and dumped them on the ground and put a wall of stones around because there were stones everywhere. And we hadn't got back to the tank very long before there was a colossal explosion and all this lot went off. But nobody else seemed to have it. We seemed to have them all. So I was very glad that we managed to get rid of them before we'd loaded them on board and they started smouldering in there. And you couldn't very well chuck them out, these, because these smoke shells, when they go off, I mean, they go off and just spread smoke, but they can still do a lot of damage with bits of metal flying around.
Well, that sounds like a subject for a unit inquiry.
There was nobody there to bother, and we didn't bother anymore. That we'd got rid of them, and that was it. But there should have been something done.
Well, you've got away lightly then, because as I say, there's a board of inquiry should have been convened on that for dangerous ammunition.
Yes, I know. Out there, who cared?
You might have done if you got more of the same batch.
Yes.
But talking of gunnery training, do you have any knowledge of the sub-caliber training equipment, where you put a Bren gun with on the main gun, so you can train the gunner?
No, really, we used, if we did any firing where you couldn't fire the big gun, we would normally use the machine gun of whatever Beza, Bren, whatever it was, on the tank, to give training at firing at targets, and being able to get your aim on the target from the same gunnery aid that you had for the big gun. So, and that was also done, well, the man in the co-driver's seat, he just fired it over sights, more or less, but because it was really not a gun for accurate firing, it was just to cover an area. But we did it for the main gunner by using the machine gun, which was alongside his main gun. And you could use the same firing mechanism, more or less. You could use the same sight and so on, which not only gave you practice firing that gun, but also aiming and controlling the main gun.
On the Sherman, how is the elevation and traverse dealt with?
On the Shermans that we got, which I wouldn't say they were early ones, but they were probably late early ones that the Americans shipped over to us, we still had mainly manual mechanism for controlling, well, certainly for controlling the elevation and depression of the gun, but for the turret, there was some assistance in having not a push button, it was a trigger mechanism that you could turn it left to right when you got some hydraulic assistance while you were doing it. It wasn't all hand and arm effort.
So it was sort of power assisted, rather than fully automated.
Yes, it was power assisted. Mm.
And you were saying that the overall the impression on the Sherman was good. Everyone welcomed it.
Yes, and apart from the extra armor which you had around you, the way of controlling it and driving it and all that, you did have this sort of rounded feeling, you felt that you had a better chance of shot glancing off rather than coming straight in and that sort of thing than you had with the old flat face. tanks which we'd had before.
What was the drive on this? Were you using sticks again?